Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity of National Review is back today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, every time you go away, an already insane world just gets crazier. So it's good to have you back.
Yeah. There's nothing like looking through the newspapers when you're away and seeing something that sounds utterly horrible and saying, hey, I don't need to read about that.
I turn
the page to the sports section and everything's fine. I don't need to spend more time reading about terrible people doing terrible things.
Exactly. We'll get to the really bizarre, bad, and crazy martinis in just a moment. But we actually start, as usual, with some good news. This is the Fox News version of the story. The FBI has expanded its probe of Hillary Clinton's emails, with agents exploring whether multiple statements violate a federal false statement statute, according to intelligence sources familiar with the ongoing case. Fox News is told agents are looking at U.S. Code 18, Section 1001, which pertains to materially false statements given either in writing, orally, or through a third party. Violations also include pressuring a third party to conspire in a cover-up. Each felony conviction is subject to 5 years in prison. This phase represents an expansion of the FBI probe, which is also exploring potential violations of an Espionage Act provision relating to gross negligence in the handling of national defense information. So we kind of figured over the past few weeks that this might be petering out, given the fact that Hillary Clinton's the likely Democratic nominee. The idea that there could be any charges here seemed further and further remote. But with an expanding FBI probe, even with the political ramifications going on right now, this seems to be a very serious investigation.
Greg, call me crazy. It almost seems like the FBI thinks Hillary lied. She wouldn't do something like that, now would she? Now, it seems pretty obvious when she says, I never sent or received classified information. That's just flat out false. And you say, well, it's a public statement. If lying to the public was a crime, then every politician would be behind bars. We wouldn't have anybody in government. Remember, that's what got Martha Stewart, though, is that if you tell something false to investigators investigating a crime, even if you're not guilty of the original crime they're investigating, they can still charge you with this because, you know, you're not supposed to mislead investigators. So interesting discussion about whether this is really targeted at Hillary or whether it's targeted at Cheryl Mills. The fun question will be whether she'll say, look, I told everyone to tell the truth. For some reason, my staff decided to lie of their own volition, of their own decision making. And this was not, I was not involved in the cover up of this in any way, shape or form. It is kind of intriguing. It'll be interesting to see if Hillary decides to play, oh, they're on a fishing expedition. But the fact that the FBI is treating as if saying something false to them in the course of the investigation is a crime, I think greatly increases the likelihood that there will at some point either be a headline of Hillary indicted for lying to FBI or Hillary's chief of staff, Cheryl Mills, indicted for lying to FBI. And both of those would be a very big sign of trouble for her campaign.
Absolutely. So we'll see what happens from here. Of course, Hillary Clinton will brush it off until she actually has to respond to any charges against her or a subordinate if, in fact, the Justice Department decides to go in that direction. Okay, on to the bad martini now. And as we all know, Tuesday night was the fourth Republican presidential debate. So that meant Wednesday was the day to dissect winners and losers and possible shifts and trends in this campaign. And on MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews, he was talking to reporters about some of the different moments in the debate, and there was a reporter named Amanda Turkle, I believe, from Huffington Post, who pointed out that Ted Cruz, without naming names, went after a lot of people with his response on immigration being an economic issue and being about protecting American jobs. He was clearly going after Jeb Bush and John Kasich, but she said it was also a veiled shot at Marco Rubio, which led to this bizarre response from Matthews.
Is he trying to insinuate that Marco Rubio, a fellow Spanish surname, I'm not sure the right word is Hispanic for them, because they are Cuban nationals or whatever, or come from Cuba. But is he going to insinuate that he's still basically for what he calls amnesty?
And she says the answer is yes. So in those 15 seconds, Jim, as you point out in the Morning Jolt today, Chris Matthews has no idea what an Hispanic is and no idea what a Cuban national is.
Yeah. And you know, I suppose you could say there are a lot of things that Chris Matthews doesn't know, Greg. But but these are pretty relevant if you're going to talk about them on national television. And at one point I remember, you know, is this worth the Cuban national? You know, maybe he meant to say Cuban heritage or something like that, that he maybe this was the Espico. I believe it was Gruber who said it was a verbal typo. I didn't really mean to say that. Fine. Okay, whatever. The claim that the term Hispanic doesn't really apply to them. This is pretty clear. This is Chris Matthews saying, look, well, they're not real Hispanics, you know, because real Hispanics are Democrat And Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio are Republicans. Anybody who disagrees with the thinking of Chris Matthews is not an authentic minority, because Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC, is precisely the person who should be the arbiter of what a minority's authenticity is. That's Chris Matthews in a nutshell. It's kind of what we've come to expect from this. The only other point I'd add is that not long ago, Jonah Goldberg asserted that Ben Carson was more authentically black than Barack Obama was, because both of his parents were black and he had a more traditional or more mainstream upbringing than Barack Obama, you know, having times in Hawaii and Indonesia and things like that. The whole world of political correct outrage just came down on Jonah Goldberg for having the audacity to say that. You know, Chris Matthews says this, we will note it, but nobody is calling for Chris Matthews to be sent to sensitivity training. And, you know, his here's another white male denying the authentic lived experience of a Latino.
Yeah, there you go. And it goes across, you mentioned Carson, a lot of discussion, whether it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or Jonathan Capehart saying, you know, that Ben Carson doesn't really speak for black people. And, of course, we had the strangle comment with Carly Fiorina at the Hillary rally that Hillary laughed at. And, of course, when Trump had a guy at his town hall who suggested Obama was a Muslim, there was a hue and cry about why Trump didn't correct the guy at his town hall. But no such advice for Hillary. So, all right, on to the crazy martini now. And this has kind of been the consistent theme this week. When Ian Tuttle was here, we started with the Yale administration on Monday apologizing to folks for not being more sensitive about Halloween costumes and frat parties. But the big story this week has been the situation at the University of Missouri, where ongoing protests and a hunger strike forced the resignation of the president and the demotion of the chancellor. Now the school's come out with this whole slew of politically correct reforms that they're trying to implement here. On MSNBC yesterday, Thomas Roberts was speaking with Missouri Student Association Vice President Brenda Smith Lazama, and she had a couple of issues. First of all, she essentially defended the crowd for trying to stifle the press at the protest following the resignation of the university president.
Several members of the media were very pushy, a little bit to the point of aggressive, while trying to approach us while we were in the circle right after Tim Wolf announced his resignation.
Now, to Robert's credit, he did quote a professor who said that what we're seeing at Missouri and some other places is basically the attempt to stifle any disagreement, much less any sort of hostility or hate on campus. And here's how that exchange went.
Do you believe that that's a place that we're heading for American campuses now, a place of censure and prohibition?
I personally am tired of hearing that First Amendment rights protect students when they're creating a hostile and unsafe learning environment for myself and for other students here. I think that it's important for us to create that distinction and create a space where we can all learn from one another and start to create a place of healing rather than a place where we're experiencing a lot of hate like we have in the past.
Oh, the First Amendment is a threat to the safe space. Jim, this reminds me of a South Park episode on Comedy Central a couple weeks back where the safe space was the focal point. Here's a quick clip from that song.
Everyone likes me and thinks I'm great in my safe space.
My safe space.
People don't judge me and haters don't hate in my safe space.
Your safe space.
Bullyproof windows, troll safe doors.
You get the gist of it. So, Jim, essentially now the Constitution and our most basic freedoms and protections are a threat to people who might disagree with what we have to say.
That's a good song. great. You know, I'm going to be humming that for the rest of the day. So one of the things that you're going to hear a lot of commentators making points like this, these are such nebulous terms, right? That they have an environment of hate. Well, what's the environment of hate or a safe learning environment? You know, every time I got a bad grade, Greg, I didn't feel like I had a particularly safe learning environment. threatened to the fact that I might fail because I wasn't always a good student. And kind of this, like, how do you learn if you're constantly afraid of being confronted with something you don't like? And this whole idea of what, how do you define hate? Right. What is hate to this person? It seems like I didn't disagree. The lament that the reporters were pushy and aggressive. Look, we weren't there. Maybe they were. But you know what? In life, you're going to deal with pushy, aggressive people. These are basically college students saying, please don't make us develop the skills that you need to have in order to make it in this world. Please don't teach us endurance and ability to handle adversity. We don't want to deal with that. It's too hard. We all kind of can chuckle about the rude awakening these people are going to get when they leave the college campus and have to go to a job interview and say, I'm sorry, I need this interview conducted in my safe space. I find your questions about my qualifications to be aggressive and pushy. But on the other hand, like, it's kind of fascinating. You wonder, this woman's being in the national spotlight, and she seems to have no idea how ridiculous she sounds. She's lamenting the First Amendment creates an atmosphere of hate. How do you – is there a spectrometer you use to measure a atmosphere of hate? Some sort of you know, wind speed thing to tell you that? You know, look, you're going to have to deal with people who disagree with you. You're going to have to deal with people who don't like you. That's just part of basic reality. And it's kind of fascinating to see how adamant these college students are that they insist they never be forced to deal with this. Unless they're going to become professional students for the rest of their life, what do they want to do with their lives? You know, that will, you know, keep them in their safe spaces. They're like, look, life is all about leaving the safe space, leaving the nest. You know what, Greg? I should use that as a selling point for heavy lifting.
I was just going to say, how well prepared are these people to do some heavy lifting? It doesn't seem
there,
like
– this is how the magic happens, listeners. This is how all of a sudden great slogans come along. So, yes.
And they should probably take it to heart that the administration probably didn't like everything they were saying, but they had a constitutional right to say it. So maybe you ought to extend that to other people. That was kind of the whole point of the First Amendment, I believe. Oh, Jim, welcome back.
It's good to be back, Greg. I'm glad to see the world a lot better while I was gone.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Friday for the next Three Martini Lunch.